Everything was chaos when I grew up. It was all chaos. It was my norm. Even to this day, I love chaos. I'm very comfortable in chaos. Even when I got a prison sentence, I was comfortable in the prison. I grew up with it because I think I'll always need chaos in my life. And my wife said to me the other day, I always need to scratch that itch. And there has to be something. And if it's not sports at an extreme level, it's going to be drugs or drink or something.
Tough upbringing is a phrase we sometimes hear about in the stories of people who've achieved success. Well, upbringings don't come much tougher than that endured by my next guest on Insights with Sean O'Rourke. You may have seen Ger Redmond on the Ultimate Hell Week series on RTÉ Television, where participants are pushed to the absolute limits of physical and mental endurance by members of the elite Army Rangers. Ger Redmond, good to meet you. We'll talk a little later about your early years. Your story, I think, is a really great example of someone who somehow managed to turn a life of deprivation, disadvantage, crime, imprisonment and missed chances into an opportunity to make something of yourself, of your family and in a way to help your community as well. Just tell me, because it's I think about 5 or 6 years since you were on Ultimate Hell Week, what are you doing now?
At the present moment I'm working in Overstown, which is a juvenile detention centre for kids. I'm an online coach and I also work for a multinational company, Amazon, as a mechanical engineer there.
You work with Amazon, but I suppose, you know, you're an Ironman in more ways than one, because how many of those Ironman events have you competed or completed at this stage?
I'd say I've done 14 full Ironmans and probably 20 halves, which is 70.3. That's half the distance of a full one.
And for a guy who couldn't swim before, like literally a few months before you did the first one, that's one heck of an achievement, Ger. But look, it's a remarkable story. Take me right back. You grew up in Darndale, just on the north side of Dublin.
I did, yeah. Darndale is, as you probably well know, it's a deprived area. Growing up in Darndale, for me, like at the time, you don't really realise how you're growing up and how you should be growing up. You have nothing to gauge off. But I know now that the upbringing that I had was not a good one, that's for sure. Although it shaped me to who I am today. But the house would have been cold. There was no warmth in the house, no love. When I say warmth, I mean love. And no warmth, but no heating. Wouldn't have got much of a dinner. Breakfast, lunch and dinner wasn't a thing of in that home. I remember I used to wet the bed. I was the little lad that sat in the bus and no one would sit beside and I would be slagged off because I'd be woke up late and I'd be wet the bed and there was no hot water, I wouldn't be put in the shower. I'd be just sent out onto the bus. For some reason, I was in a school called Conceely, which was an affluent area. I'm not too sure how that came about, but
Charlie Hottie lived in Conceely.
Yeah, it was actually right beside Charlie Hottie's house. But for some reason, I was in that school and the coach used to pull up outside the house and I used to dread getting onto the feckin' coach, forgive me language, because I used to smell and I'd notice people slagging me, I wouldn't sit beside me. So I used to dread that for years. I dreaded getting onto that coach. Well, you know, through soccer, through sport, I found a family through sport. I always did. For some reason, I got a connection with sport. Very, very good connection. Didn't know them, but I was obviously using it as a tool from a very young age. I felt part of something when I played soccer with the lads out on the road. I didn't feel that in the home. So I always felt like I had a family.
And in your natural family, your birth family, I mean, how many of you were there? And your parents, I think, had their own, if you like, shortcomings or struggles.
Yeah, like any family would, you know. Like they were very young, having myself and the other siblings. I think my mother might have been 15 or 16, having us. So they were very young, very inexperienced. And my mother had a lot of her own trauma growing up, you know. She was adopted and I know she lost her mother and father at an early age, which would have had a huge impact on her life and how she brought us up. I don't think she ever experienced love herself. I know that it's very hard to give someone something that you never had, because I grew up without her and I know how difficult it was for me to show love and emotion to my kids. So I understand all that. My father would have had a mother and father growing up. I know my granddad would have been a tough man. I actually liked my granddad's approach to life. He didn't take much bullshit, like, you know. But he would have been a tough man growing up on his children, like. So, but like, you know, I don't really excuse me for that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and there was kind of a family tradition of being in jail, was there?
Yeah, so, look, if you want to move forward, my whole thing is to change the generation, because my granddad had done a prison sentence and so had my father. And then I remember the first night I ended up in prison, I was like, fuck, I just done the exact same thing. I cursed my own dad for doing on me and my brothers and sisters, and I've just done the exact same thing on now my family. So I just seen a generation thing there, and then you see it all around you in deprived areas, like, you know, everyone talks about their uncle being an armed robber, or their uncle being a good drug dealer. And it's a generation thing. It's the environment you grow up in, and it's wrong on so many levels. And until you break that cycle, until you actually grab the horse by the reins yourself and do something about it for your generation, and, you know, protect the people coming from behind you, until you actually do that, it's going to continue on.
And what about education, you know, in your community? Was it seen in any way as something to be valued?
No, I would have never seen that like that, no. Like, I struggled for years in school. My street sense got me through school, because I used to pretend I knew how to do things, you know. People with street sense are very clever. They know how to pull the wool out of people's eyes, you know, when they need to. And I learned from an early age how to be clever. And how,
streetwise,
street sense. You can't buy it. Like, it's a very good tool to have in your bag, but you also need an education. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to.
What kind of things did you see around you when you were a kid?
Like, I would see rob cars all the time. There was always someone knocking at the door selling stuff. There was always people on drugs. You know, there was always addicts all around us. And then, look, at the age of 10, me and a friend of mine, we followed. We seen some man getting chased by a gun. And we followed him on a bike, and we actually seen the man getting shot dead. And that was at the age of 10. So that was early in my age that I witnessed that.
Did you know who did it?
Well, at the time we didn't, but like now we know, because the man actually got, you know, we ended up getting a sentence for it and that. So we know the story about it now, but at the time we didn't. We just seen it and then scarred off.
And did you, I mean, were you traumatised by it? I mean, or
Not really, to be honest with you, because everything was chaos when I grew up. It was all chaos. It was my norm. Even to this day, I love chaos. I'm very comfortable in chaos. Even when I got a prison sentence, I was comfortable in the prison. I grew up with it. And it's like trauma in a way, because I think I'll always need chaos in my life. And my wife said to me the other day, I always need to scratch that itch. And it has to be something. And if it's not sports on an extreme level, it's going to be drugs or drink or something. Because it's like trauma never leaves you, you know.
Did you get involved in drink and drugs yourself?
I did, yeah. Like when I grew up, if you just go back to when I was playing soccer for Dublin team down in the Limerick, down in the Kennedy Cup in Limerick, really good.
That's an underage competition, isn't it?
Yeah, so you make it for the Dublin squad, which I was picked. Then I went down to the Kennedy Cup. Then I was playing in the Milk Cup with Dunfermline, a Scottish team, because they had come and watched me, a scout came and watched me. And I was playing with Columbus and Coolock, and I was picked to go over and do a trial with Dunfermline.
You set out to impress the coach, did you?
Oh, I did, yeah. I was always trying to impress, yeah. And that's the thing as well. I was trying to look for that, you know, people to say, well done, because I wasn't getting that at home. We never got that at home. Well done, you've done great. So I was always a crowd pleaser, yeah. Always a crowd pleaser. I know that I was, yeah. I used to try and do my best to look for the kudos, you know.
So Dunfermline, what age were you when that happened, or that opportunity came your way?
15. I was 15. I think it was 15 and a half or something that time. Look, I was playing, I don't know if you've ever, I don't know what you know about them, the private areas, but it's grim. And you don't get many opportunities. You really, really don't. And I don't know if any of your listeners ever had a dream whipped from beneath their feet. Like, you have this dream in your hands and all of a sudden it's just taken, you know.
But you did get a taste of what opportunities might come your way. You went to Dunfermline. How long were you there and what happened when you were there?
So, but just to take you back, the first time I went over there for a trial, I stepped off the flight, went straight to a match. They kicked me out in brand new gear. I couldn't believe it. Like, I was playing FIFA the week before with Dunfermline. Like, couldn't believe it. None of us could believe it, even my friends. It was just a dream come true. When I got off the flight, they put me on the bench. They were losing 2-1. I come off the bench and scored 2. We had 3-3, and I laid up the winner and we won 4-3. And the rest was history. The team I scored against wanted to sign me. the manager of the Force team brought me around East End Park, which is in Dunfermline, the Pars they were called, and offered me a YTS scholarship. I couldn't believe
that's
it.
That's a youth training scheme?
Youth training scheme. I could not believe it. Like, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't wait to go home and tell everyone. Dream come true, like, absolute dream come true, because I always knew I was going to do it. I was that confident. I was that confident with the ball. I loved football. I loved it so much. Like, I can't even explain that love. It's like loving your kids or, you know, it's...
So you were there, and presumably you were in a part of the youth setup training. What was that regime like?
That was just going into work every morning, like work. You know what I mean? It's not really work, but I was getting a bus in from East Fife. I was staying in East Fife, which is a little town off Dunfermline. It was about 8K or something. I was getting a bus in every morning, going in, washing the boots, having everything ready for the pros, and getting their kit ready, putting it out on their places, getting myself ready then. And then we'd get the coach down to the training ground, with everyone on the coach, and then like playing football, like, come on. You know,
what kind of money were you getting at the time?
I think I was getting like 140 sterling or something
a week.
Yeah, a week, yeah, which wasn't bad, you know what I mean. I never kept any wage slips, like, because I was getting wage slips off them, but I never kept any. But look, it wasn't even about the money for me. I didn't really care about the money, you know. I was kept in digs. They were feeding us breakfast, dinner, lunch, you know what I mean. When we were in the East End Road in the stadium, because that's where their HQ was, we would be fed there as well, do you know what I mean? So, like, I didn't care about the money.
And what kind of prospects did they tell you you had then?
Well, I knew, because I could see the other lads progressing that were ahead of me. Say they were at the end of the YTS, and then they were offered contracts, and you could see them getting, they were getting $2,000 a week then, you know what I mean? I was like, wow, imagine getting $2,000 a week, like. And yeah, we were just looking up to them. You knew by what was in the club. These are just inspirational people. And these are just people you want to be.
And then it all came crashing down.
I got caught at home. My father had committed a crime of manslaughter back home in Dublin. And yeah, like, I mean, like, I wanted to go home just to see what was happening. When I got off that flight, I didn't realise how deep the hole was going to be for me, you know.
And sorry, how long had you been in Dunfermline before you got that call?
About 6 months. So I was playing my trade. I was doing well. I was doing ball boy at Rangers matches, Dunfermline Rangers, Dunfermline Celtic. I was playing tournaments. Celtic and Rangers were involved in the tournaments. I was doing well. Like, I was playing ball. I was playing my trade. I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. So I was going the right direction. You know what I mean? I wasn't going the wrong direction. That's for sure. I wasn't getting thrown home. I was continuing my dream.
So home you came anyway. Your dad had gone to jail.
Yeah, father went to jail. I came home, the house was boarded up. Went in, mother had people in the house they shouldn't have, that were drinking. And it was chaos. It was just absolute chaos. And that, like, I made that decision then. It was either go back over. I had two choices. Go back over to Dunfermline and become a pro, live my dream, leave my brothers and sisters, or stay and, you know, be the man of the house, which is what I ultimately had to become. Not a very good man, to be honest with you. But at the time, that's what I done.
How many of you were there at that stage? Your mother didn't stay in the house for very long, did she?
My mother left us about a month later. She left, went to Liverpool with another man. And left myself and my younger sister.
Aged?
She was 17. I'd say 17. I think I was 16 at the time. Yes.
And who are the younger ones then you were looking after?
So that was four brothers and sisters under the age of 10.
Wow.
All babies. Babies.
How did you go about taking that on?
I don't know. Do you know? It was like a bad dream. That's all I can explain. I didn't know what was happening.
But I mean, for instance, were you able to get children's allowance? Did that keep coming to give you know, some few quid to, you know, literally put food on the table? Or how did all that work out?
Yeah, so my sister would have been able to, I don't really know, but I'm just assuming, because I never really asked these questions, you know what I mean? But I'm assuming she had to have some sort of state benefit coming in the door, do you know what I mean, to feed us, because at that stage I wasn't doing anything. I was just home from Dunfermline, didn't know what was happening, trying to regulate these new emotions. I went from putting the ball in the back of the net to putting food on the table to protecting my family, living the dream, you know.
And was that a hard decision, or was it just something instinctively, Ger, that you felt you had to do?
It was an instinct thing. It was just like, I couldn't. Even if I would have went over, I wouldn't have been able to cope with that, you know what I mean?
Do you ever regret that decision?
No, I don't ever regret that decision.
So I mean, were there social workers involved or any of that kind of thing?
I'm sure there was, like, but you know what? I gave up on adults then. I gave up on adults. I didn't want to talk to adults. Like,
At this stage, you were what, 16, 17?
Yeah. I just didn't care. Like, I didn't want to talk to anyone. Go away. Leave me alone. Do you know, I did that much hatred towards adults.
So, did you, I mean, was it you and your sister, or just her mainly, I mean, who provided the meals, who did the cooking, cleaning, washing, that kind of thing?
It was her. I can't take credit for any of that. All I done was sort of protect them. Anything happened, I made sure that I was there looking after them. So I couldn't even play football after that. I tried, but I'd go training and something would happen or something would be on my mind. I couldn't even play ball. And that really hurt me because my love for football was taken away from me. I couldn't even play it anymore.
So what exactly was your contribution then?
Just protection. And if we needed food, I made sure there was food on the table.
How?
I joined the criminal gang. So that was my... I just made the choice to join the criminal gang for protection because we are getting threats still, for this.
Because of what your dad had done?
Yeah, yeah.
And joining a criminal gang, how did you find them? What did being in the gang involve?
So I was a runner. So to start off in a criminal gang, you have to start at the bottom of the ladder. It's always the same. So you start off being a runner, bringing stuff around, making a few quid, gaining the trust, you know. Then you might be holding stuff. Again, you're gaining trust, you're not a rat. And then before I knew it, I had this vent up energy. So I'd gone around fighting with people and making a name for myself.
Were you what would be called an enforcer?
Not really an enforcer. But if someone owed me money, I would make sure I got me money. I wouldn't go around enforcing for other people or anything. You know what I mean? I wasn't doing anything like that. But if someone owed me money, I would get that money.
Were you dealing in drugs?
Yeah, dealing in drugs, yeah.
So what kind of money, how did that compare, your income from that compare with the money you were making in Dunfermline?
Oh, look, again, it was only pittance, you know. At that age, you're only making pittance. Like, you're just making enough to put clothes on your back. You're not making any big money at that age, you know what I mean? Like, if you're making £50 a week would have been at the time, you're happy if you can get yourself something to eat. It was just to survive, really.
And did you make sure the younger ones, you know, they went to school and that kind of thing?
Yeah, we did. Like, my sister, again, I done none of that. I'd be lying to you if I told you I did. She would, like, if she told me they're not going to school, you'd have a word. But she done most of the work. I couldn't take credit for that, you know. Mm. She was the heart of the whole operation, to be honest with you.
So how long then did your involvement with the gang go, Ger? I mean, for how many years was that, leading ultimately to you going to jail?
Like, so from that happened, I think I was nearly 20 years. But in and out, I wasn't continuously always in the gangs, you know what I mean? I was in and out, trying to do better, trying to make good of myself. But the trauma used to come back and then I'd take drugs again, you know, because I couldn't sit with it. And then I'd end up back on the wrong road and you try and go back on the right road and back off. So it was,
what kind of drugs were you taking?
Taking cocaine and smoking weed then at the time. When I was younger, I smoked weed, but kept that up. I didn't really like that. But mainly drink, really, to be honest with you, because drink was easy, accessible, you know what I mean? You'd get drink, no problem. You used to sell them out of houses down in Coolock and Darndale and that. So you'd have no problem getting them at any time of the day.
Mm. What age did you start drinking?
Say about 16, 17.
Right, just around the time you came back, yeah.
Yeah, just I didn't know how to regulate their emotions. Mm. So it was easy just to stem them out.
Yeah, and then at what stage did you end up getting involved in serious crime and going to prison?
So I got the sentence in 2013, so that I would have got involved in serious crime before that, a couple of years before that, where it was got a bit heavy, you know. And to be honest, I was glad I got locked up. Looking back now,
For what? What did you go down for?
For drugs, again, drugs found in the house. And
What kind of value was put on those?
I think it was 55,000 or 60,000.
55,000
yeah,
euro?
Something like that, yeah.
I mean, would you have considered yourself or would you have been considered to be a serious player at that stage?
I wouldn't. I'd never see myself as a serious player, no. I'd never say that about myself, you know.
And how many others were at the same kind of level as yourself or the same rank, if I can put it like that?
Like, you wouldn't even know, like, unless people are mouthy about it, but there's, like, everywhere you looked, there's people making money because that's what people do in a deprived area. A lot of people get involved in that because that's the way out.
And, like, did you supply to other people? Were you selling the stuff in town, that kind of thing?
No, not really. Just sort of giving it to other people.
And what kind of friends, male or female, had you got during those years?
No friends. You don't have friends. Like, you think you have friends, but they're only accomplices. You know, that world, anyone does you a favour wants something back from you. There's no mates. They're only your mates until you, they're only your mates while you're doing something for them. Soon as you're gone, you can't do anything for them anymore. You're no longer a me. You're no longer an asset to them. So it's not, there's no friends in that game.
Prison changed you, did it?
No. Believe it or not, it didn't. Now, I'm glad I got locked up because I learned a lot from it and money can't buy the experience that I had there. But it didn't change me because when I got out, I went back into the gang. My son changed me.
But life in prison, I mean, you did have a certain realisation, I think, when the door closed behind you on your very first day or your very first night in jail.
Yeah, the first night when I was in jail, as I said to you earlier, with the generation thing, I realised that what my father had done on me, I had just done on my kids. So I just passed down the same emotions. I had kids at the time that were crying because I was now locked up.
And how many children had you at that stage?
I had 4 kids at that stage. Yeah, 4 kids.
And so it was kind of history repeating itself. That was your sense.
Exactly. It's the generation thing. And we see it all the time. We all follow in the footsteps of the people before us because they're their heroes. And we know no better. And it's the environment that they set up for us that we follow.
How long were you in prison?
I was 18 months in prison. So I got 2 years. I actually got 3 years suspended. And then I got reactivated because I'd done another crime. So then I got 2 years. I got 2 years sentence.
And out you came and back into the whole gang situation again.
Back in because that's the life I thought I was, the only life that I was going to have, because when I was in prison, I thought, I have a conviction now. No one's going to ever trust me again. I'm not going to get a job. So I sort of gave up on myself and I gave up on society in that sense that I thought, they're not going to trust me. So I just went back out making money, you know, the way I knew how to, and the easy way, you know. But it's definitely not the right way.
And then your son was born. Why was that such a big turning point?
Because when my son was born, the last thing I wanted him to look at me and say that I was full of shit. Because my dad used to tell me not to do things and he'd be doing them. And I remember saying to myself, he's full of shit, like a hypocrite. I despise hypocrites. I don't like people who say they don't do this and they're not doing it. It's just one of my pet hates. So I swore that I was going to change my generation. I swore that this kid's going to be put on the right road, but I'm going to have to put myself there first. And then he'll automatically follow my footsteps. And the environment I'm going to create is the environment that he's going to follow. So when he was born, that was my insight. That was what I was going to do.
And there was a moment as well, I think, where a friend of yours, or maybe an acquaintance, I'm not quite sure which, had died.
That's right. So I was actually in Amsterdam with this lad and we were having a few drinks, and he had a son at the time, and he told me that his son went to the doctor with him and the doctor was going to give him a needle, and the son was like, no, I wouldn't let the doctor near him. And all. He was just telling me about little bonds he had with his son, you know, because obviously my son was coming along and I was asking him. And then I think it was a month later that guy died. And I remember being at his funeral. And I remember sitting there with my hand in my head and I was looking at the kid walking up to the coffin. And I remember, like it was yesterday, and I remember looking going, like, if I continue on the road I'm on, that could be my son one day.
And this child was aged what about the time?
About 6 or something. Mm. He was young, like, and all he wanted, and this is where the light bulb moment came as well for me, because all that kid wanted was love. He wanted to play with his dad. Didn't want anything external. Didn't want any money. And this is what we get into the gang in the first place for, because we think we're providing for our family, giving them money. But they don't want that. Your family want love. That's all they want. And all this kid wanted was his dad to grow up and play with him. And that's it. And that simplified it for me.
What age were you when that happened?
32. Yeah, I remember I was 32. And that was a realisation for me. And I felt if I continued on this path and put my son through that, I'm evil.
It's one thing to see that and to have that realisation, but it's another to kind of find a way, you know, to pick your way through all that you were engaged in and involved in and indulging in to getting out the other side. So talk me through that.
Well, see, I believe I was always meant to do something great. And when I was a kid, I got that opportunity and it was taken from me. I never wanted to be on that path. I never wanted to be selling drugs. I never wanted to be haunting people. I never wanted to be put in that position. I was put in that position by a bad generation, by a father who couldn't get shit together, by a mother who couldn't get her shit together. left us in the turmoil of their trauma. So I never really wanted to be on that road. So it was always in my mind to do better, to be better. And I hated the fact that I was treated bad, and I wasn't going to bring that onto my own people. I feel if you don't like being treated bad, don't treat other people bad. Yeah. So that was always my mindset.
So what did you do then?
To change. So I actually surrounded myself with a couple of lads. My mate of mine, Mick Akio, he was doing Ironman at the time, a good lad, mad into his sports. I started surrounding myself with him. I had to pay off all the bills that he owed, so I had to play a bit of chess around that.
You don't really mean chess, do you?
No, chess in the sense of street sense, because you have to use your street sense, you know, and this is where that comes in. It's very important.
And you had to extricate yourself as well from the gang, yeah?
Exactly, but the only way to do that is to pay off all your debts. Then they don't have a hold of you. So I was clever in the sense where I paid off all my debts, and then I was just like, look, I'm going to do an Ironman, my son's just born, you know?
An Ironman is a big thing to take on, isn't it? Like, just remind us of what exactly is involved. Like, there's running, cycling and swimming.
So it's 3.8 swim. It's 180.
3.8K, is it?
Yeah. 180K on the bike and a full marathon, 42.2. Yeah.
There were certain shortcomings in your... I mean, okay, the will was there. You could run, presumably you could cycle. Tell me about the swimming bit of it.
So I couldn't swim. I remember going up to Trinity and I'd no even goggles. And I'd get into the pool and I didn't know what I was doing. But see, taking up this sport, I was just looking for something new. You know, I just wanted a different, something new in my life, something positive. I wanted to surround myself with different people. And this is what you have to do. You have to drop the old and gain the new to produce something. You know, you have to change. The only way to change is by changing your circle, you know. You've got to really do that.
Yeah, but you're looking at the water, right?
Yeah.
And you can't swim.
Hmm.
You need to be able to swim, what, 3.8K?
Yeah, yeah. But that wasn't my mindset. My mindset was if I can train for this, if I can learn a new skill, if I can just... I never had even thought I was going to do the swim. That's the truth. I just said, look, I'll be in a better place come 6 months.
And how long did it take you to be able to swim 3.8K?
Probably 3 months. See, I'm an extremist. And as I said to you earlier, what my wife said, I always need that itch scratch, do you know what I mean? So when I take up something, I want to be the best at it yesterday, and that's just who I am. So if you tell me I can't do it, I'll say, can I not know? You know?
So you must have been going into the pool, I mean, like, you know, maybe more, spending more time in it than an Olympic swimmer or something like that, or somebody who had those kind of aspirations.
So I was in the swimming pool every day. Every day I'd go to the pool and learn new. I was on YouTube, I was looking at all different stuff, buying different gear. And within a month I was doing 1 kilometre, then 2 months, 3 months. And then I was able to do the swim. But then the difficult part was to transfer that into open water, which is a total different beast. And I didn't realise that when I went into the sea for the first time, I was like, I can't swim, you know. But it's just about, it's the zero visibility in the Irish Sea. You know, you can't really see anything in front of you. So it was just getting over that side of it. Once I got over that, then I was flying, you know. But look, it's like Anton, you know, you put your mind to it, you can achieve anything you want in life. You really can. And I suppose that proves
and
it.
And you've done all of this now in the last 10 years, really, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't just, you know, Ironman events in Ireland that you wanted to engage in.
No, so we've done them all over the place. We've done them in Maastricht, which is in Holland. We've done Lanzarote, which is the toughest in the world. I've done Wales, which is the toughest in the world. I've done Switzerland, which is the toughest in the world. You know, I've done Barcelona a couple of times.
Which of them really was the toughest that you had to do?
I tell you, Lanzarote, I went back 3 times to try and time it. That's the toughest one, the heat and the wind. The wind is like 32 kilometres an hour against you. You're climbing 2,500 metres elevation, and the heat down on the run's probably 32 degrees. It's extreme, but I loved it because I love the pain of sport. I love that pain. I'm comfortable in the pain.
Well, I suppose in your mind or in your head or in your thinking, you must have been saying, well, you know, I've come through, or were you saying you've come through tougher situations?
This is not pain. Training and sport is not pain. I can bring people back, I'll show them real pain. Real living is pain, you know. What we go through, what people go through on a daily, that's pain. People losing loved ones, people, you know, with addiction problems, that's real pain, you know. I've had trauma for many years and that's pain. Sport is not a pain. I don't put myself out there as a top athlete either. I put myself out there as a person suffering with trauma, and this is just stemming my trauma.
Yeah, but people who would have watched, say, the Ultimate Hell Week, and they would have seen, and I think it's one of them on your website, that conversation you had with the counsellor, which goes on for several minutes, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, and you know, your vulnerability comes through in that, and your honesty. And then when it's over, you know, you say, okay, you're ready to go. And the next thing we see is there's a your head is being covered. And so, I mean, are you saying none of that made you afraid?
Oh, no, not really, no. Like, I was opened up. No, it did, actually, because, like, that was the best show I've ever done. That show has really made a man of me. You know, it's them men, like...
The Army Rangers guys.
Ah, look, I could talk about them all day. They're unbelievable. What I'd have to say about them wouldn't justify who they are, you know. They're the best people you'll ever be around. It was a privilege to be around them men. And that's the truth of it. An absolute privilege. And I thought to myself, if I can be even a snippet of them, I'd be doing well. But I remember one of them, Goggins.
That was Ray Goggins you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the man, yeah. He pulled me asunder one of the days. And it really made me look at myself inside, you know. He said a couple of things to me. And he wasn't lying, because I knew what he was telling me was true. So I knew he wasn't winding me up. You know when you have a weakness and you don't tell anyone, but someone spots it. And you're like, they can't be lying, because I actually have that and I don't tell anyone, right? You get me?
Remind us.
Right? So I had a weakness. I just wasn't confident inside. So I was the captain of a Brava team and I just couldn't control them. I just, under pressure, I was shit. And that just came from just, my self-belief wasn't there. My confidence wasn't there. It was all just, see, this was all taken from me when my father committed that crime and was brought home. I was the most confident person you'd ever meet before I went to Dunfermline. I was full of confidence. I'd be talking to everyone. The wind was taken from my sails and I hadn't fixed it. And when he said that to me, I knew he wasn't lying. And he made me feel that size. But you know what was the best thing for me? Because when I got out, I attacked all that. And I went to the root cause of why that happened. Why am I like that? And I got counselling and I got psychology and I worked on myself. Like, I worked on myself weekly for about 7 years.
You know? And are you still going to counselling or getting counselling?
No. I gave her up. Not because...
You sacked the counsellor, did you?
Oh,
job done.
Geez, no, I actually didn't. No, I sort of got to the end of what was the real cause, you know. Which I'm only sort of coming through in the last few months. Like, I had abandonment trauma, you know, that I didn't really realise I had. So that was a massive part and I would never talk about it because I had it buried that deep. Mm. But thankfully I've got through it and that was a very tough thing. It's like someone giving up drugs, you know. It really is. Like, people don't really understand trauma out there that don't have it.
So you did the Ultimate Hell Week and then you started building from there because you had a bit of a profile.
Yeah.
So how did that help your other ambitions? I mean, for instance, the Ironman thing. I mean, you don't get paid for that, do you? Even though you call yourself a professional athlete.
Look, you don't get paid for it. The only thing you get from that is you get sponsorships. And you'll only get sponsorships if you have a lot of followers on Instagram or a social media platform. I got that through the likes of Hell Week. I've done a couple of other shows here in RTE. And, so I got a bit of a profile that way and people followed me. So then I built up my profile. That's the only reason I even got sponsorships. It was nothing to do with me as an athlete. And that's the truth of it. It was just because I could give something back.
And then you provide this personal one-to-one coaching to people.
Yeah, so online. So everyone wanted to work with me then because of my no excuses attitude. And you create your own tribe when you have your own attitude. So a good coach of mine told me, be yourself, because you can't please everyone. So I was just being myself. I said, I don't care if I only get one or two or three. But actually, people out there love the no excuses attitude. People out there love accountability from someone like myself to say, no, we're actually full of shit. Like, you told me you were going to do this goal. You're not doing the sessions. Get your finger out and do the sessions. That's what I'm paid for. Do you know what I mean? But that's me transferring my attitude.
How long have the clients generally stayed with you? I mean, or do they do you break them and then they go away or what happens?
But look, I'm there to do a job, right? Someone comes with me and says, I want to do an Ironman. We have to structure a custom program around that man or that woman's lifestyle to suit their goals. If we do that and that's what suits them, that's the weekly sessions, you need to hit them sessions. If you don't, and I don't say anything about it, I'm not doing my job, am I?
You're kind of scaring me already, Ger.
Well, you're not my tribe then. <You know? laughs>
And you mentioned Amazon. What do you do for them?
So I look after the data centres. I'm part of the mechanical team up there.
Okay, yeah. So you're not actually coaching them. It's actually a technical job.
Actually,
you
a technical job. Yeah, believe it or not. I just said, you know what? If I got an opportunity to work for a multinational, and this is all part of my story, because I want to show people out there that are in prisons, that have been on the wrong road in life, that have convictions, that people out there will give you an opportunity, and that's it adds to my story, you know. And some of these jobs I take, like I got my taxi license, I couldn't get it for 3 or 4 years because of my convictions, and I persevered, and I just persevered just to show other people you can do it.
But did you ever actually work as a taxi driver?
No, I just got it just for that reason. Just to say to people, you can't actually do that.
I mean, surely it makes sense that people who have criminal records and have been in prison shouldn't be driving other people around the place, strangers. No.
Well, I'm gonna tackle you to that. So let's have a discussion around that. Why is that?
Just a matter of public safety.
No, but like everyone has an opportunity to change. You have to give people opportunity to change. You can't keep putting people on that road and not letting them, giving them opportunity. How are they ever going to change? How are we going to change as a society?
So how did you succeed then in persuading them that you could and should be trusted with a taxi licence?
Because of what I was doing in the community, because they knew I was no longer involved in crime. So you do have to do a little bit extra, do you know what I mean? Mm. But I didn't do extra for that reason. I done extra because that's who I wanted to be. So when you show true change, the guards will change with you. They will give you opportunity. And that's what I proved. And that's what I wanted to do, because then when I go into the prisons, I can say, no, I have it. Because as I said to you earlier, I'm not a bullshitter. So if I tell you it can be done, I'll do it first. Then I'll tell you it can be done, because it's a fact then.
Tell me about your work in the prisons. It's Oberstown, that's the youth detention centre for young men. Is it girls as well?
Yeah, girls as well, yeah.
So how do you deal with them?
I deal with them like I deal with anyone. I show them respect. I become friends with them. I don't ask questions. I don't ask any untoward questions, and just befriend them and try and build up a relationship with them, because with these kids are very vulnerable, and like me, these kids don't trust adults, because most of them have been similar roads to myself. So if you go in as an adult asking questions, start being an authority, they're just going to rebel against you. So the best way to work with kids like that is to be their friend and just have an understanding and an empathy within inside you. If you can just put yourself in your worst position, the worst thing you've ever been through, right? I mean, you meet these kids, put yourself in that position. Get that feeling, of that emotion. That's what they're going through right there and then, all the time.
How long does it generally take you to connect with them and get a sense that you're actually achieving something with them?
Like, it took me a while at the start when I only started working there, but now I have it down to a T. So I'm much better now, you know. Yeah, they know me now. Do you know what I mean? I'm more trusted because I'm there. I'm consistent. Seeing the kids, when a kid's vulnerable like that, a consistency in the kid's life like that is massive. Constantly turning up, constantly showing up. You know what I mean? Showing them that you're there. You know, don't bullshit them. If you tell them something's going to happen, do that. Make sure you do that, you know.
And essentially what you do is what? Physical fitness, training, that kind of stuff?
So the way I've done a couple of talks out there, it was 3 years ago, and it made a huge impact on the kids. And the director out there asked me to come out and have a chat, and he said, would you like to do something on a permanent basis? What would you do? I said I would get them to vent a negative into a positive, exactly what I've done, because a lot of these kids have trauma, and if we can get them to vent that through sport and get them to use that as a tool, I think it'd be a massive change in their lives. And it's made a massive change in their lives. Like, I get them out there, I have a triathlon room out there, so I have a rower which simulates a pool. Obviously we haven't got a pool, so I chose a rower, and then I have a Watt bike, which have two Watt bikes, and I have Swift on an Apple TV, and I get the kids to race each other. It's like PlayStation. So that gives them something different, you know. You're not just putting them on a bike, it's like a game. So, and then we have the treadmills. So I have coached people, kids out there. I do an 8-week course out there on sprint triathlon, Olympic triathlon, and I've coached two kids out there to do a 70.3 half Ironman, which is massive. That's a 1.9 row, a 90k bike, and a half marathon indoor, right? Which is a total different beast than doing outside. You don't get the air, the temperature is up. You're on a bike for 90k, right? And then a half marathon on a treadmill. Absolutely massive.
Like, are you there roaring at them? Well, this is a goal.
I'm there roaring at them. Come on. No, we trained for 6 months for that, you know. I was going in there three times a week.
What's your view of prison? Do you think it's something that can you know, perform a useful service in changing people, or is it just a question of locking people up and keeping them away from doing harm for a period?
God, prisons are run, they're not run very well. You know, in prisons, there's an 18-month waiting list for psychology, for addiction services. You know, 90% of prisoners go in prison within 16 months. Like, it's ridiculous. There's no help when you go into prison. The services aren't there. The people that are in there are suffering. Look, at the people in there that are in the prison, we never condone violence, we never condone crimes. They're all wrong, absolutely. But you need to give them the opportunity to change, and the opportunity is not being given in the prisons. When you go to prison, the only thing that you're being punished for is your freedom. That's the punishment, is your freedom is taken from you. But they're not. They're in there getting punished. There's people on 23-hour lockup, they have mental health issues, and they're not being given the service that they need. And it's a letdown by society, it's a letdown by our government, and they know about it. And they're in there, and they're like caged animals. You wouldn't keep a dog in a dog pit for 23 hours. You wouldn't. That's the truth. I wouldn't keep my dog. I have a dog that lives in the house. I put it out the back and the kids go mad. Like, it's an absolute disgrace the way the prisoners are being treated. And people out there that don't see that obviously have no empathy around it. They've never had anyone in prison. They've never been in prison. And they've never had any troubles like that. But it's an absolute disgrace that we're still treating people like that. There's people still pissing in buckets and going to the toilet in front of each other. You know, it's not.
Do you think prisons could be run in such a way that actually they would change more people than clearly, you know, they do or don't at this stage?
Absolutely. We need the services. When you go to prison, if you're given the right services at the time that you need that service, that's the right time to get it. You know, that's the time where you will actually seek the help and get the help.
When you were there yourself, Chair, for 18 months, did you get anything that was positive that maybe would have helped you or could have helped you?
Like, I went to school. I went actually to Toastmasters. That actually helped me, to be honest with you. Like, look, what I'm talking about is, look, the school there, there's a gym there. The gym you only use when there's enough officers. So, but yeah, look, I learned how to play the guitar. I done my junior cert, you know. I filled my day, you know. But I'm talking about the real services, the services that the people need, because I'm not getting it outside, because you know how much it is for a couple of counseling out there is €120 an hour. Single counts is €80 an hour. You're not going to have the money for that, right? A lot of people out there who are struggling don't actually have that money. So you're put on this list, you know. So it's just not sustainable. Something needs to change in this country if you want to help people on a bigger note, you know.
So if you, for some, somehow manage to become, you know, director of the prison service or in charge of it or the Minister for Justice.
Yeah.
That's what you would do. Put those kind of services in there.
Absolutely.
Make them available sooner for people.
Absolutely. That's what we need. That's what these people need. These people need to talk and get the real cause out. And by talking, see, people with addiction, I don't think it's addiction. I think it's trauma. And once we walk into trauma, we won't need the drugs to stem it.
And before people go into prisons, they generally come from deprived areas. Anybody who has worked, whether it's John Lonergan or other people in the prison service, will say, look, you know, they come from particular postal addresses. What do you think can be done for those kind of areas to change them, or can they be changed?
Yeah, look, I mean, I had an idea. Like say, Alberstown. Alberstown is a massive, massive influence, massive inspiration for them kids. They have the right services there. So I believe opening up some sort of a super youth centre within these areas, that we can offer these kids the right things in life, like counselling, like feeding them properly, showing them how they should be fed. A lot of these kids that are growing up in the areas are being brought up by people who were brought up by a bad generation. And it's a knock-on effect for everyone. Everyone's just, they're like going around circles, you know.
You do some work yourself with athletics, with running in the area that you grew up in.
Yeah, so last year, in August last year, we opened up a running club in Kilmarnock. So that's been a massive impact on the area. We have 120 active members, people who never ran before. So again, we're giving them that tool to use in their lives, because I just think sports has saved my life. So I've seen that, how massive a sport was in my life, and I wanted to reach back and share that tool with others, you know.
And I mean, how often does that group meet, or do you have sessions, those running sessions with the people?
Wednesday night, we meet at Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, up in the Prizewood car park, so the coffee drop. And then we meet on Sundays at 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. at the same place. And we have four different groups. We have six coaches. We have a committee. We're AAOI official, all insured. So it's not just like, you know, it's a proper club. Like, we have our own kit and also.
And where do you, or how do you see that developing from here out?
Well, that's going to, I think that's just going to keep growing. Like, I mean, when I took up that project, myself and a guy called Anthony Brady took her up, I wasn't thinking 1 year. I was thinking 20 years, you know. And it was in the line, it was in my mind for about 3 years, and I was like, I fucking haven't really got time for this, you know, I've enough on my plate. But I couldn't dismiss it. Talking about people's lives here, and for us to give a tool like that for people's lives.
And do you think you've succeeded so far anyway in being a better parent to your own children than your own parents were to you and your siblings?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Like, I love my kids. I do everything for my kids, you know. I need to be more present. You know, I think we're all guilty of that, not being present enough, because we have to work, we need to do certain things.
And do you see any limits to what they can achieve educationally, career-wise, any of that?
No, they can do anything they want. Like, anyone on this planet can do what they want. And my view on that is, if you can do it, so can I, because you're made of the same stuff I'm made of, you know. So if another individual can do it, so can I.
What are your ambitions?
Ambitions? My ambition was to save my generation. That was the main thing. Even becoming a pro, that wasn't the golden nugget for me, you know. Although people think, oh, that's a great achievement. The biggest achievement in my life was securing my family, you know, staying with my wife, loving my wife. Yeah, just changing that whole generation, the whole dynamics, because if I didn't, I was just going to send all the ones behind me were going to go down the same road, you know.
She must be a very special person.
Yeah, she's very special, actually. I don't actually give her enough credit, to be honest with you. Like, without her, I probably wouldn't be where I am. That's the truth. And, you know, for years, anyone that knows they have a good wife, they'll tell you, you're full of shit. And she told me for years. And I actually thought she was jealous. I was like, why? Like, I actually thought she was against me. But actually, she was the one that was putting me straight, do you know? So she has been, to be honest with you, she's been the boss in all this. She's been the one that has saved the generation that I set out to save. Because without her, we wouldn't be where we are today. So
it's great to be able to say that. Did you ever think about getting into politics or anything like that? I mean, or do you think you might have the patience to deal with bureaucracy?
I would. I actually was on that show, Eating with the Enemy. And that was what I was around, because I don't believe in politics in the sense of the votes. Because I believe once you vote, they just make their mind up and do their own thing anyway. But this guy challenged me. He said, well, hang on a minute. Like, the only way you're going to make true change is through politics, you know, which was a valid point. So, yeah, no, it is something that I would like to get into maybe if I had time. But at the minute, like, I'm triple jobbing at the minute. So, but it is something that to make true change within the deprived area, that is the right route to go, you know. So it is something could be something in the future.
Are you completely the exception to the rule in the sense that you have turned your life around in a huge way? Or do you know of other guys who've done something maybe in a less high-profile fashion?
Yeah, look, I know a couple of lads. There's actually a lad in England called Johnny McAvoy. He's actually a Nike sponsor. He was in for a life sentence for armed robbery. He broke all the indoor records on a rower, smashed them all, and he's now doing massive work, and they actually took the license away. So when you get life, you're on license forever. But they actually took it away from him for him to give him more freedom. He lives in Switzerland now, I think. But he does massive work around London and around England for kids, trying to get them involved in sport. So something similar. So he's had a massive change in his life, you know.
Well, look, I think I've probably taken up enough of your time, Ger Edmund. You're a busy man. You have lots more to do. Thank you so much indeed for having this conversation with me and providing lots of very interesting and valuable insights.
Thanks very much for giving me the platform.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.